So we're starting. We're in the Ein Yaakov. Tana de Be'elio. Wow, we're up to one of the most exciting stories. It shows up here in the Talmud in Shabbos. It shows up in Tana de Be'elio. It shows up in Avos Dir Rabbi Nosson. This is, I guess, is a pretty important story because it shows up all over. Now you guys have to listen closely because it happens to be a fantastic story, but it's also a story from which we derive many halachot. So maybe we should introduce the story. Okay. We have a prophet named Elio. How do they say that in English? Elijah? Okay. Elio is given the task to consistently stand by the Jewish people. So Elio goes from human to angel. Whatever that means, don't ask me, I don't know what it means. But in some level, Elio becomes an angel, and he's still working. On Pesach night, we pour him a glass of wine. At a circumcision, we prepare him a seat. We say that Elio still comes to the major events in Jewish life. Questions later, okay? So Elio would appear to rabbis when they were learning. If they merited it, then Elio would come. So it's not exactly prophecy. It's learning from someone who was very big, who was a prophet, who's appearing in the form of an angel. So it's not exactly prophecy. On the other hand, it is some capacity to tap into ancient tradition. So the Talmud tells us that Rav Anan used to have a steady visit from Elio, and Elio would teach him. And we have a whole work called Tana de Be Elio, the Medrash that was learned at the hands of Elio, at the Academy of Elio, which basically Rav Anan compiled from his learning from Elio. And that's why sometimes in Tana de Be'elio, Elio says, I did this and I did that. And it's Elio talking. So this story that we're about to read also appears in Tana de Be'elio. Earlier this week, when we quoted the story about Rabbi Elazar ben Rabbi Shimon, who was walking on the beach, and that man showed up. So we said in Tana de Be'elio, it writes that Elio says, I showed up. Remember the story of the man who was totally deformed and deranged, and he asked him, hey, does everyone from your town look like this? Remember the story, guys? Mm-hmm. From the beginning of the week. You weren't here. Okay, you don't remember. When we were learning about arrogance, and then he went after him, he said, I don't forgive you. Right, so that was Elio. How do we know it was Elio? In Tana de Be'elio, Elio gives it away. I mean, you read it in other sources, and it doesn't say who the man was. I guess the other sources heard the story from Rabbi Elazar or Rabbi Shimon. So they never got the backdrop to the scene. Then comes along Tana de Be'elio, and Elio says, hey, it was me. I got dressed up. I wanted to teach him a lesson. So this story, too, appears in Tana de Be'elio. Again, there are slight changes there. And we'll discuss that as we continue. So, Tana de Be'elio. We have a Braisa, a Tanakh quote, that was taught at the Academy of Eliyahu, which we understand means this Braisa basically comes from Tana de Be'elio. We have, like we said, we have a whole work, Tana de Be'elio. Maise story, betalmid echad, we have a student, Sheshanarbe, learned a lot of Mishnayos. Karaharbe. You guys prefer I read with an English accent or Hebrew accent? What do you prefer?
Hebrew accent.
Lo mishane. Ken?
Hebrew. I don't like your English accent.
You're outvoted. Okay.
Just because you're English.
He learned a lot of Tanakh. V'shimesh tamdei chachamim harbe. So he also learned Talmud. He had his time in which he learned under the sages. Umet b'chatzi amav, and he died especially young. V'ayta ishto notelet tefilav, so his wife used to take his tefillin. Maybe next time we'll discuss why she took his tefillin. So, she's taking his tefillin. U'mechazelt bebatei nesiot u'bebatei medrashot, and she'd go around the different shuls and academies, batei medrash, where people were learning. V'omeret lehem, and she'd tell him. Here she is, a widow. She's coming with her husband's holy tefillin. And she says, Katuv b'Torah, the Torah says, Ki hu chayecha v'orech yamecha. The Torah is the source of life. The Torah is the source of longevity. Bali, my poor husband. He learned so much Mishnah. He learned so much Tanakh. He spent so much time studying under sages. Why did he die young? So imagine a widow comes up to you, holds her husband's tefillin and says, you see how old these are? My husband, you know how much Torah he'd learn late into the night, early in the morning? Mishnah, Tanakh, Talmud, why did he die young? So what are you going to answer a woman, right? So everyone was silent. No one said anything. You're going to start arguing with a widow? Elio says, I visited her. And so she started her whole spiel with me. You know what my husband used to do? You know how much my husband used to learn? How could it be he died young? The Torah says it's the source of longevity. Elio is about to answer her. Before we read Elio's answer, we need a few introductions. What do you think is the hardest mitzvah in the Torah? Hardest, most difficult to perform.
Consoling the bereaved.
Huh?
Consoling the
bereaved. I didn't hear.
Consoling the bereaved.
I'm asking, what do you think is the most difficult mitzvah?
Waking up from Kriyat Shema.
Yes!
So I think most married people would say the most difficult mitzvah is the mitzvah of family purity. Here you're living a life, and suddenly the Torah says for 12, 13 days out of the month, the husband and wife can't touch one another. They can't pass things from hand to hand. Okay, that's, I said married people. I understand for single people, you know. Okay, but I think that in the span of life, I think most people would say that's high up there at least. You know, Kibbud Av V'Em is hard. There are other mitzvahs that are hard. Fasting on Yom Kippur is hard. There are mitzvahs respecting rabbis is hard. There are a lot of mitzvahs that are hard. Okay. But I think most people would put that high up there. So we have this mitzvah, wow, which is a difficult mitzvah. The Torah says that when a woman has her onset, so the couple split. Okay, so they're still friends, they still talk, they still joke. They have to be careful not to joke about things that would lead to intimacy, but they're still leading the house together. But suddenly they don't pass things from hand to hand. Suddenly when she has leftovers on her plate, he can't eat it. You know, she drinks half a cup of tea, he can't finish it. She's got half a cup of coffee, he can't finish it. At Kiddush, he just puts down the cup and she comes and takes it. He doesn't actually pass her the Kiddush cup. You know, so there are things that suddenly invade every aspect of life. Suddenly around the house, she's a little bit more modest. She doesn't, if ordinarily she can be more free with her husband when other people aren't around. So now she's a little bit more careful. So, it's difficult. Comes the Torah and says, when a woman has her period, the couple is prohibited. And now we won't go into what's biblical and what's rabbinic, because that would take a whole long 2-3 classes. But in a nutshell, the minute a woman has her onset, the couple is prohibited. Once she ceases to have her onset, so technically, biblically, so long as her period was under 7 days, at the end of 7 days, including all the days she had her period, so she could go to mikvah, and then they're pure. We have another concept of a zava. When a woman has her period and it's not part of a regular cycle, so then she has to wait until the period stops and then count 7 days clean, and then she may go to mikvah. Now, today we treat every woman as though she was a zava, meaning any woman that has her period, she doesn't count 7 days from the beginning of the period and then go immerse. She waits until the period stops, which usually takes about 6 days. And then she counts 7 days that she's clean, and only then she goes to mikvah, and only when she comes back from mikvah are the couple permitted. So there are about 13 days when the couple are prohibited. Now, what this fine fellow did, this Talmud Chacham, was that when his wife would finish her period, they'd wait the 7 days, according to biblical law, she'd go to mikvah. And then, according to the way we do things, they'd wait the next 7 days until she had seven clean days. But what did he achieve by his wife going to mikveh after the first 7 days? That they'd touch one another and they'd hug one another and they'd go to sleep together. They were never intimate because they waited the 7 days, the seven clean days. But he did tell her to go to mikveh right after her period ended. Now, that's against the halacha. And that's what Eliyahu is about to tell her. Now, you understand that from this story, we derive many halachot about the laws of family purity. Because in the story, in the conversation Eliyahu is going to have with her, we're going to understand, we're going to infer from the conversation what's permitted and what's prohibited. So the story begins. He's a guest at her house. Eliyahu is about to give her an answer. And she's telling him, "My pious husband, who learned so much, how come he died so young?" And in truth, there's no validity to that question. You can ask the question about many things in life. The whole book of Job, the whole book of Habakkuk. You have a lot to talk about on a philosophical plane. Why do people suffer? But to take a specific instance and say, okay, now answer that, that's really not a fair question. You want to discuss at large, so it doesn't really matter if her husband died young or not. Like we've mentioned before, this whole question has to be discussed. Why do children die ill? Why do children suffer? There are many questions that have to be addressed. And those questions have to be addressed irrespective of whether her husband died young. But being that her question is not, why do people suffer in this world? Her question is, why did my husband die young? So even though that question isn't such a fair question, you want to ask in general why people die young, okay, we can discuss it. But it's as though everything else works in the world. The only question she has is why her husband died young. So Eliyahu is going to answer just that. And I said to her, BT. Now, BT is a term of affection. The older people would sometimes speak to younger women and use that term. If it's a relationship, like Eliyahu, when he appeared, he might have looked like he was 150. And this woman is like in her 20s or 30s. So there was this, it was like accepted. Just like they call older people grandma, even though she's not their grandma. So the term, yeah, you know, to call grandma, I don't know. The Talmud says there are halachic criteria that fall based on when a woman feels comfortable being called grandma by other people. I'm saying there is such a stage when, yeah, it's obvious she's a grandma, you know.
She is 70, 80.
Right. There comes an age where there's an obvious gap.
You hear it quite often.
What?
In Jerusalem, you hear it quite often. Young guys, they help old women and they call them
Tata. Yeah, it's pretty accepted that it's a term of respect. It's not denigration. Wow. I'm saying, I can understand in other cultures it might be denigration. Here it's respect. When a neighbor, some neighbors when they're younger and they want to have a relationship with your kids, they'll say, "Call me Dod Ari." And older ones might say, "Call me Saba Ari." We had neighbors, they weren't religious. But they had adoptive grandparents. They had made aliyah together. They became friendly. So they would always call him Saba Avi. Okay? The man had no relation whatsoever, but he took him under his wing. So, by the same token, sometimes the older people would call the younger people my child, like BT. She's not his daughter, but that was the norm in conversations. So, he says to her, in a gentle term, he says to her, BT, "Bimeni tutech mahu etzlech," when you had your onset, when you were menstruating, how did he behave? Amrali, she said to me, "Chas v'shalom, afilu be'etzba ktana lo naga bi." God forbid, he didn't even touch me with a pinky. "Bimeli bunech ma'u etzlech." But what happened when you were clean? "Achali mi v'shatai mi v'yashan mi b'kiruv basar." Ah, then he ate with me. He drank with me. We slept together in bed, and in those days they slept without pajamas. "Velo al tadato al davar acher." But I can tell you, nothing ever happened. We were never intimate until I got to mikveh. So I added what some Rishonim learned, that they went to mikveh once and then they went the second time. So now Eliyahu hits the punchline. "Don't throw eggs at me." Eliyahu says, "Baruch hamakom sharago." Thank God, God killed him. Shelo nasa panim la Torah. He didn't have any respect for the Torah. Sharei Torah amra. The Torah says, Ve'elisha benidat tumata lo tikrav. The Torah says, when a woman has not yet gone to mikvah, it is prohibited to come close to her. It doesn't say only it's prohibited to be intimate with her. It says, don't even come close. So, what do you want? He ate with you. He drank with you. You guys slept together. Okay, so what's your question? Why he died young? So being that she was going around complaining, insinuating that the Torah is not real, so he answers her very sharply. He says, thank God he's dead. Okay, it's not what we usually say to a widow, right? Okay, coming back to our story. So here in Tana de Be'eliyo, there's a longer version. And over there, he asks her, maybe he passed you an item and you touched one another as he passed you the item. So from here we understand that we don't pass things from hand to hand when the woman's until the woman goes to mikvah. She makes the food and puts it down on the table, but she doesn't put it in his hand. Meaning you could put down a cup on the table, you don't have to give it to his hand.
Is it that if he drinks from a cup of tea, she cannot drink, or she...
No,
she
just drinks? The other way.
Okay, I understand that.
The guy is always the problematic one. Girls are better behaved. Yeah. If he drinks a cup of tea, she could finish it. Yeah. So some people look at these halachos and say, oh boy, Judaism is so strict. And I say, oh boy, Judaism is so romantic. Meaning it's a given that when you're going to pass something to your wife, the nature that Chazal expected is that there'll be a slight caress as your fingers pass one another. That's why Chazal say, don't, when you're prohibited, don't do it. But that indicates to us, what did Chazal expect would happen when you're permitted? Chazal expected that you don't miss an opportunity. That, yeah, when you pass something to her, you'll give a small caress as you pass it. It was a given. So they had to say, okay, so when you're prohibited, you're not just going to pass things from hand to hand. You might slip. So don't even pass things from hand to hand. And so on. I'm saying there, the idea that don't finish her drink. Don't eat from the same plate. So Chazal expected, you sit down for spaghetti and meatballs, if you're comfortable, that you could sit down over one bowl. It might not be the most modest thing to do in a restaurant, but you sit down at home. Chazal expected that that's how it would play itself out. And etc. As you learn the laws of family purity, you have to see it from the other vantage point. How did Chazal expect our homes to look when we're permitted? Because they expected such a great connection and so much warmth between the couples, so that's why certain things would be at least a cause for concern that they might lead to intimacy. Meaning people sometimes look at the prohibitions and say, wow, this is tough. I said it's tough. I'm not arguing with that. But at the same time, it's supposed to help us understand what life is supposed to look like when we're permitted. Tov, but you guys aren't chassanim yet, so we're not going to spend too much time on this. B'marava ki ata Rav Dimi amar, when Rav Dimi came from Israel to Babylon, so he said an aspect of the story that we didn't have in this quote, and that was mitachada havaya, they slept in one bed. So here's another one. From here we learn that when a couple's prohibited, they may not sleep in the same bed. And that's why Jews have two beds, and when they're prohibited, so they split the beds. The beds don't even touch with one another. B'marava amre, in the west, from Israel they said, ma'avitzak ba Yosef, sinam afsik beno leveina. That it wasn't actually the way I described it, that they went to sleep together, and in the days of the Talmud, they didn't wear pajamas. That's like real severe. But rather, she wore an apron. They had an apron separating between the two of them. And so there was at least some kind of separation when they went to sleep at night, and sure, nothing happens. And even that's prohibited. So here again, we have the halacha, that even if a couple will go to sleep fully clothed, when they're prohibited, that's prohibited. They can't go to sleep on the same bed. What?
Is it better to have two rooms?
No. There are cultures where it was developed, this idea that they have two rooms, and usually, excuse me for being blunt, but usually the wife gets kicked out to the small room when they're prohibited. It's not that there are two rooms. There's this big king-size bed where the master of the house sleeps, and the little old wife gets kicked out to some other room. You'll be with the kids, you know. That's not the approach that Chazal described to us. I know that this custom evolved in certain places, but the general approach that we have is that the two stay in the same room. And more than that, the Talmud describes that. Okay, we'll give the full picture. The Talmud says as follows. There's a verse that says, Neshei ami tegarishun. The women, the wives of my nation, you have banished. Mi beit tanugia. From her house of pleasures. That's a verse in Tanakh. So the Talmud says, what's this talking about? The Talmud says, it's talking about a situation where a guy asks if he could sleep over. And he knows they live in a studio apartment. So if he's going to sleep over, he's going to be in the bedroom with the couple. And even though he knows, like he saw the way they passed the keys, that he put it down on the table and she picked it up. So he knows they're prohibited. It's not that by his spending the night there, he's going to prevent them from being intimate. Nonetheless, about that, Chazal say, Neshei amite garishun mibet anugia. You're chasing my women out of their house of pleasures. Why? So the Talmud says that when a couple goes to sleep at night, even if they're prohibited and their beds are separate, so they're sleeping on two separate beds, the final minutes before they fall asleep, there's intimate chatter that goes on between them. It's not that they're talking about intimacy, because that they're not supposed to do when they're prohibited, but the way in which they speak and joke around and their final conversation before they fall asleep is something that's very precious to the woman. And so Chazal say, if you ask to sleep over that night, she's not going to feel comfortable having that conversation with her husband. And that, the Talmud says, is inappropriate. The Talmud says, why are you taking that from her? So you see, the Talmud was so sensitive that even that final few minutes of conversation that takes place between a couple, Chazal say, has to happen when they're prohibited. We're not talking about when they're permitted. So you see, Chazal's vantage point was that there's a lot of intimacy even when they're prohibited. There are certain things that we don't do in order to ensure that we don't come to sin. But the relationship is as strong as ever. Yeah. And Chazal didn't say, well, no problem, just kick her off to the other room, you know, big deal.
She can speak, record, and after that...
Right, okay, so all these wonderful solutions, you see the Talmud didn't say. Cell phones, right, SMSs, cell phones, right. Yes?
How does that, you mentioned talking until you fall asleep, how does that interact with, like, bedtime Shema and things
that? That's a good question for when we learn that piece in Talmud. Right now, that was a tangent. Or on a Thursday night, right?
Yeah.
Okay. But